We're considering this morning Senate Bill 159 from the landlord tenant bill. When we had our last hearing, last two hearings, been for proponents of the bill. Today is for opponents of the bill. However, there were a couple of people who were left over last time that were proponents, and I said if they came today, we'd let them testify. Now, is there anybody here that was here at the last meeting that wanted to testify as a proponent that didn't get an opportunity to? Okay. You want to come up? Except for this, it'll be opponents. Thank you for waiting until today before I had the people from afar last time this week.
I kind of feel like the proverbial bad penny. I'm always turning up. I'm Wanda Merrill, Administrator of the Consumer Services Division of the Department of Commerce, and I won't take but a minute this morning to tell you of some of the problems that we have encountered, complaints that have come into our office as a complaint handling agency. In November and December, we had 37 complaints, mostly regarding repairs and cleaning and security deposits. In January, the total official complaints filed was 16. And if I may, let me just briefly outline a few of the examples that would be covered in this particular bill. In the matter of repairs, we had a gentleman call, his electric stove was sparking. The landlord said if he insisted that it be fixed, the landlord would raise the rent. A gentleman asked that the furnace be fixed. The landlord said he didn't have to do it and immediately gave him 30 days notice. A landlord and his son did the wiring and then warned the tenant not to heat two rooms at once because it would blow all the fuses. In the matter of deposits, we had a young lady move into an apartment with a dog. She paid a dog and a security deposit. The linoleum was in bad shape, admittedly, by the landlord when she moved in. But when she moved out, the landlord, although he admitted that the linoleum was old and marked, wanted to keep the dog deposit. We had some young men that moved out of an apartment on November 29th. It took them until January 10th to get their money back. And we had a landlord that rented a house 8 days after the tenant moved out, but he didn't return the unused rent or the deposits for 2 months. Essential services, of course, during the cold spell, as you can imagine, we had a deluge of calls from different people that didn't have heat or water and the landlord would not supply it. We had several cases where a rental has rats, roaches, or other small animals, you might say, and the landlord says if you don't like it, you can move out. One landlord told a tenant after the cold spell that from now on he'd be responsible for any frozen pipes or anything else that happened due to weather. The landlord would not fix it. A tenant tried to reach the landlord or the owner or the manager for a couple of days and was unable to do so. Finally, his plumbing was so bad that he had to call a plumber, so he called us and said, who's going to pay the bill? We were forced to tell him that he might be able to. We had a tenant who rented a house and was told by the landlord that the roof leaked. Said, don't worry about it because I have a man coming out to fix it right away and it will be taken care of. 3 months later, nothing had been done. We have a tenant that told the landlord the hot water heater wasn't working. Here again, he just told her to move. A lady with frozen pipes called the landlord. He didn't respond, so she called the police. The police came out to see what the situation was. While they were there, the landlord came, and he immediately gave her 30 days notice. Now, these are just a few of the cases that we've received in our office. With no landlord-tenant law in Oregon, the tenant faces living with such deficiencies or moving. And landlords are quick to tell a tenant if he doesn't like the situation, he can just move out and find other quarters. This sounds simple, but here the tenant is faced with looking for a suitable rental, he has moving costs to face, new deposits again, and a myriad of other problems that one encounters when changing residences that perhaps you don't always look at. The curtains don't fit, the furniture isn't quite right for the new place, and the children are uprooted from their friends in school. We feel that action is desperately needed in the following areas: fit premises by the landlord and, of course, by the tenant, some terms regarding deposits, landlord harassment, repairs, and certainly disclosure of responsible contacts so you know who to go to in case you do have a problem. These are but a few of the items that are covered in Senate Bill 159 that we feel deserve your scrutiny. Thank you.
Do you feel that Senate Bill 159 is going to take care of those situations?
These problems, yes.
You had a question, Senator?
Yes, Chairman London, I was wondering, on the complaints, how do you proceed to get a complaint? Do you, can take any one of your examples, what do you do in your office once you get the complaint?
We get in touch with the landlord. And I must admit that not all of the complaints that we get are valid, but we do get in touch with the landlord and see if we can persuade him to do something about it. Even though there is no landlord-tenant law, quite often they will help.
That's what I was getting at. I was wondering if you had 16, I think your comments were 16 that you investigated, what percentage of those, or what I'm trying to get at, is what percentage of those are false claims, and what percent of those were resolved roughly out, precisely?
I would say that probably about a fourth of them would not be valid, and the rest of them would be.
And of the 75% that you get a valid complaint, what percentage of those would you say are resolved by your intervention on behalf of them?
Probably about half, because the landlord knows he doesn't have to do anything.
Are there other questions?
Mrs. Merrill, I'm sorry I missed your testimony, but does the governor support Senate Bill 159 as written?
I'm sorry I can't answer that because, as you know, there are two other bills, landlord-tenant bills, are up, and one has been printed, as I understand, the other has not. So I wouldn't be able to say which of the three he might prefer, sir.
Could we find out?
Yes, sir. I'll be glad to. Would you like me to report back to the committee on
yes,
this? I'll
would.
Be happy to do so, sir.
The other one I think you're referring to has been printed on one, the House Bill 2424.
Yes, sir, and I understand there's a 2542 coming out that perhaps has not been printed yet, to my knowledge, anyway.
Other questions? Senator Carson.
Just out of curiosity, on the case or two that you mentioned that there were late return security deposits, did you have to ask the tenant whether he was ever late? His rent payments during the period of time that he...
No, I haven't, but we have had cases where they have reported to us and it has turned out they haven't paid the rent.
And one final question, can you help us on what fit premises are? You know, you indicated that one direction we ought to go and 159 calls it is fit premises. And we've been haggling over what constitutes fit premises. Some suggestion is that he has to be 72 degrees at all times and some of the other things.
No, I personally wouldn't go that far, although we did have the Salem area seniors call us with a case where an elderly couple were living in an apartment with steam heat and the manager of the apartment kept the heat at 60 degrees, which is certainly not enough for that age, let alone for most of the rest of us. But I would certainly say that the cases that we've had where the roof leaks down in the baby's bed or where there are cockroaches all over and nothing is done about it would not constitute fit premises.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
George Kearney.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is George Burney. I'm a lawyer from Portland, and I represent the Oregon Apartment Association. This is a corporate trade association having in its membership approximately 1,000 apartment house owners throughout the state of Oregon, and it is opposed to the bill. At the outset, I'd like to state that I did appear at one of the first hearings, the first hearing, I believe, and heard the testimony of those who testified in support of the bill. We had met with those folks before, and they're young and eager and frank and dedicated and attempted to encourage us to participate in their discussions. They tried to hide nothing. They were open and frank, and we wish to express to them our appreciation for the effort that they've put forward in behalf of what they think are the rights of tenants, and to nevertheless express the fact that we do not think that we can go along with this effort. the first and perhaps the basic reason why we claim that we cannot support the measure is because we think that the solution lies in some other area. Mr. Clark, one of the commissioners who testified that concerning the reasons for the bill, hastened to add that the bill was not intended to solve the problem of the low-income family or of low-cost housing. And as I sat here and listened to the testimony of the other witnesses, if we could detect but one thread running through almost all the testimony, it was the effect that the complaints came from low-cost housing occupied by low-income tenants, and that that was the bulk of the problem area. There was no real testimony concerning problems in areas outside of that category of our citizens. That was the testimony of Mr. Shannon of the Oregon Consumers League, who said that he thought the bill would assist low-cost families. That was the testimony of Mrs. Patricia McCauley of the Model Cities Consumer Protection, and she frankly stated that her interest was pretty much centered for low-income people and the low-cost housing. And similarly, Mr. Steve Hewitt of Lane County Legal Aid stated that the low-income tenants were the problems of his area, and especially in view of the fact that they attempted to compete with the student, the living off campus in the city of Eugene. Now, I am one of several witnesses who appear in behalf of our association, and these men and women are going to be able to give more details concerning that which I will merely outline. But in a word, we feel that the problem of low-income people and the housing that they must accept is not a problem which can be solved by the landlord in his relationships with the tenant or pressed upon the back of the landlord by legislation of this type, but is actually a social problem which has to be solved by government, and government is and has been attempting to solve it. The fact that these solutions have not been in all cases perfect or even close to perfect does not change the burden of the responsibility or change the emphasis on who should bear that responsibility. We feel that the tenant is not quite as bad off as many of the proponents for the legislation have claimed. It's true, perhaps, that the law has not changed since the 17th century. I think that was the remarks of Mr. Clark. But nevertheless, the courts have changed the law in a number of areas. And the really, the rights of tenants have entered in sort of a new boom of exercise of certain rights over those of the landlord and asserting his basic rights through the courts. And this has come about through a number of methods. Not really that the law has changed, but there's been a new group, particularly lawyers connected with legal aid and law firms that are identified with the assistance to the poor and the underprivileged to carry forward their rights and to assert them in the court. And we've seen some amazing decisions come forward as a result of their activities. These are a dedicated group of young professional men, and I, as a member of the bar, join with those who are my associates and members of the bar to congratulate them in their efforts in behalf of these people. And it has exposed, it hasn't developed any new law, but it has exposed a lot of existing law, which up to this time has really gone unnoticed and unattended. Also, there have been organizations attempting to assist tenants and their negotiations with landlords. An example of it is Osberg. And I hold up, so you can see, a Osberg lease packet entitled An Aid to the Student Who Plans to Rent. And in this, there are a whole bunch of no-nos to watch for in connection with negotiated leases with landlords, things to not agree upon in areas in which the agreement can be made. And these are valuable. The student should know these. And these are low-income people, just like families, although in most cases students, who have a right to know what their rights are. And I think it's fortunate that we have organizations who can advise them of these rights. I'd like to show that the plight of the tenant is not all bad. I'd like to read, sum up a letter that was written to our organization by Mr. Charles Shepherd on January 4th, 1973. I talked to Mr. Shepherd and got his permission to read this letter, and he didn't even know about the introduction of this legislation, so this letter was not written in view of pending landlord-tenant relationships. So he really wants to gripe about a situation which happened to him as a landlord to my client, the Oregon Apartment Association. And it reads like this. By the way, Mr. Chairman, I haven't got any written remarks or things to hand out, because as I saw the other hearing, there's such a glut of printed material handed around this table that I just think that the secretary would probably welcome the opportunity not to carry off any more pounds. But if you want copies, why, I'll be glad to supply them. To the gentleman, the following is a report for, quote, "There ought to be a better way," end of quote, filed. In July, we rented an apartment to a tenant without checking his reference or his application because we were hungry for tenants. That's a new twist. Here's a landlord hungry for tenants. He moved in with a partial payment of rent and a partial payment of deposit with a promise to pay within a couple of weeks. At the end of the month, he still had not paid any more money, and the manager went to them to try to get the money he owed. He then paid an additional $40, less than 50% of what he owed, and nothing on the next month's rent. As the next month went on, he kept making promises and offered for the manager to keep their stereo set and their living room chair and so forth to keep from kicking them out until they could find a job and pay their rent. Finally, at the end of the month, I told the manager to give them notice and to get them moved out as soon as possible. Again, the result was more promises that the tenant would have the money immediately. Finally, after much badgering, the tenant still refused to move, and therefore we were forced to file a legal suit to get them out. By this time, it was almost Thanksgiving. See, the rental started in July. And after we had the hearing in court, which they did not attend, we got our judgment order signed. The sheriff would not move them out because of Thanksgiving. He wanted to give them more time. The sheriff did make three visits to the tenants, and each time they promised to move before he came back again. Finally, we had to have the sheriff move the people out and are obligated for the moving van and the storage costs on their furniture, plus the fee the sheriffs had charged. On top of all that, we have to pay our attorney and make sure that we followed all the laws of the state in moving a tenant out. Shortly after we had them moved out by the sheriff, we received a lawsuit prepared by Legal Aid Society of 26 pages, suing me and my apartment manager for damages in the amount of $25,000. If I had hired an attorney to file a similar suit, it would have cost me $1,000 to have this suit drawn up. And yet these people who have never paid any rent can get it done free through Legal Aid Society. So then I found myself back in court with the sheriff and the moving company that moved the people to defend ourselves against the free legal aid. The costs to me to date are rent due, $275. Attorney's fees to move the tenants, $75. Moving costs and storage costs, $235. Attorney's fees to defend against the tenants, $131.50. The moving company's attorney's fees to defend against the suit, $250. Total, $966.50. This does not include any of the time conferring with my attorneys and going to court and conferring with the sheriff's office and the apartment manager to get this tenant removed from the premises. We are lucky in this particular case, since we are prevailing in the court and will not have to pay the damages. Legal Aid did inform us that they can't understand how we won in Washington County when they have been winning in Multnomah County and collecting damages from apartment house owners. The Legal Aid has finally agreed to drop the suit if we agree not to countersue them. We have refused to do this while we are considering the possibility of getting help in carrying the lawsuit against the Legal Aid for misuse of due process of law. And then he offered to have his attorney talk with the directors of the of my client. So we feel that the tenant is being well represented, and that a lot of the deficiencies in his position, in his legal rights as compared with those of the landlord, are not wholly valid, that he does have a valid body of law to support him in his position, and we think that these can be further enhanced and developed without the aid of any legislation. Now, I've been lobbying around these halls for about since 1947, and I've seen a lot of cats and dogs of bills come before my attention. I have never, Mr. Chairman, in all of my lobbying experience, ever seen a bill so studded with invitations to conduct litigation, to get attorney's fees, and to get penalties for failure of one side or the other to perform as is contained in this measure 159. I counted this morning, as I was waiting for this hearing to attend, some six or eight different instances in the bill where specifically the law provides the tenant the opportunity to proceed against the landlord in court and to collect not only the damages but also something by way of a penalty, and in each case, attorney's fees. We look at the bill itself and section 5 of the bill. On page top of page 2, subsection 2, says, any right or obligation declared by section 1 to 24 of this act is enforceable by action unless the provisions declaring it specifies a different and limited effect. Any other provisions. And when read by lawyers representing tenants, this is going to be an open invitation to commence legal action. And then on section 6 of the bill has a peculiar provision that says a claim or right arising under section 1 to 44 of this act or on a rental agreement, if disputed in good faith, may be settled by agreement. So the only area left for settlement and compromise is if the dispute is in good faith. Maybe there may be disputes that aren't in good faith, but nevertheless, they are preempted from the area of negotiation and settlement. You can't settle a case if both sides don't enter into it in good faith. Now, on this question of attorney's fees, I think that this statute really is unique. This proposal is unique. There are prohibitions. One of the no-nos imposed upon landlords in this case is that there can be no provision in this lease which grants that landlord attorney's fees if he should prevail, or attorney's fees in any kind of an instance. And there are a couple of other no-nos regarding contents of the lease. However, the Act does not, the Act particularly provides that in one or two instances a landlord may procure attorney's fees. So the Act does not deny the landlord the right to attorney's fees. It merely denies him the right to include attorney's fees in his contract of lease with the tenant. Now, in this day, and the reason for that, Mr. Clark said in his testimony, is that the presence of attorney's fees in a written contract of lease inhibits a tenant from otherwise seeking to obtain his rights. In other words, to see the right in the lease, giving the landlord attorney's fees, stops a tenant from proceeding. Now, we lawyers know that, I think last session, the session before, there was passed by this legislative assembly a provision of law that if an agreement of any kind, including a lease, contains a provision allowing one side to recover attorney's fees, both sides can recover them if whichever prevails. It's no longer one-sided. Furthermore, isn't it a little odd in this day of enlightenment for the consumer that we kind of keep it from his sight in a contract by which his rights are to be defined? A provision setting forth attorney's fees. They cannot be in that contract if they are in favor of the landlord. And yet by the Act, which seeks to give him certain additional rights, the landlord is actually given rights to attorney's fees. It's unlawful for a contract of lease to contain a provision awarding the landlord attorney's fees, even in those cases which the proposal said he could have. And that, I think, Mr. Chairman, is an odd situation in this field of enlightened law.
What section is that?
What?
where it says the landlord can't give...
I think that's about section five. Let's see. No, it's not five. It's section 16 on page 7. It's on line 21. A rental agreement may not provide that the tenant agrees to pay the landlord's attorney's fees. And if you, later on after the hearing, Senator, I can give you citations to other sections which provide specifically for attorney's fees in both instances.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to interrupt you, Mr. Burney, but am I understanding you to say that that section there would preempt the statutory right to attorney's fees to the prevailing party if the landlord is the prevailing party?
That's right. Well, that's right. No. Well, put it this way. If the contract of lease contains a provision awarding to the landlord attorney's fees, that is a violation of this law, which gives the tenant additional remedies. That's a no-no for which there is compensation, punitive damages, and attorney's fees. What I'm saying is that the landlord actually has the right to attorney's fees in one or two instances. But he cannot say that he has that right or mention it in the contract of lease between him and the tenant.
Well, notwithstanding the fact that he can't mention it in the contract of lease, because that is proscribed here, is not there another section in the Uniform Act which provides that any action brought on a leaseholder's agreement, which is litigated, attorney's fees to be awarded to prevailing party?
Only to the tenant.
Which one is that?
Well, there are a number of instances, Senator Burns. If you wish to take them down, I have just a partial list of them. There's sections 18, subsection 3, section 27, subsection 2, section 28, section 30, section 42, and section 43, subsection 2.
There's no general.
No, there's no general. These are specific sections because they deal in some cases only with what we would call compensatory damages. In other cases, they deal not only with compensatory damages but also punitive damages by way of a penalty. And in all cases, our attorney's fees are recovered by the tenant in these listed cases.
Well, now, in section 42, page 19, line 22, landlord and tenant, the remedies for abuse of access, in either case, the landlord may recover actual damages and reasonable attorney's fees.
That's right. And there's another section which provides, that gives him the right to recover damages and attorney's fees. But what I'm saying is, Senator, that the contract of lease between the landlord and tenant cannot contain a provision modeled after section 42, which says like this: if the tenant refuses to allow lawful access, the landlord may obtain injunctive relief and compel access, and in which case the landlord may recover his actual damages and reasonable attorney's fees, end of quote, in the lease. The lease can't say that. And I say that's a kind of a fraud upon the tenants. If he's inhibited, and I'm not representing tenants here today, you understand that, but I say that if the lease can't contain that provision, And the tenant is inhibited by the language of granting attorney's fees to landlords as contained in a lease, he must be kind of inhibited if he reads his law. And to keep it from the lease, when he might not be reading the law, is sort of a fraud on the tenant.
Well, George, isn't a reasonable interpretation of that to be that they can't have an agreement where the tenant's going to pay fees except what's specifically described in the act?
I don't think so, sir, Mr. Chairman.
That's not the interpretation, but on a very simple change, the amendment there, except for providing the second sentence.
Well, not according to Mr. Clark's testimony. Mr. Clark, you know, talked about this. I just don't think you can give that interpretation when you look at the reason why the prohibitions against that language are in the lease are made.
Well, it's simple enough to amend this.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Now, and also, bear in mind that I'm not suggesting any amendments to this bill. I'm opposing the bill. I just want to make myself clear. If I haven't learned anything...
I'd like to hear somebody tell it as it is, George.
And to give you one more fundamental statement from the standpoint of a lobbyist who's been here quite a number of years. I'm in the language of the lobby. Don't try to amend a lousy bill, end of quote. There are other ways to handle it.
Senator Carr. George, let's explore those other ways of handling it. How do you feel about a need for putting in the statute someplace the rights the courts have already established, the new rights that you're talking about? In other words, bringing our statute, if not bringing the law, bringing the statute up to the 20th century.
Well, I feel this way. Well, in the first place, Senator Carson, you asked me for my opinion, and I'm really appearing not for Bernie, but for the Oregon Department Association. I don't know what my client thinks about that. And I don't know really if I should, I don't know if I really thought out, even though I spent some time on this bill, I don't know that I really thought out the full implication of that which you asked. I'm a little hesitant to put into a statutory form the language of the law as lawyers think the courts have announced it, because lawyers themselves don't always agree on it. And it doesn't tie the hands of the court. They can still move forward, but nevertheless, I don't think that it really adds anything.
Then let me ask, what are your alternative ways of handling the problem?
Well, now, we haven't, in your mind, you have a problem. I assume when you ask me that question, I'm not so sure I have a problem, or my client has a problem.
I thought I heard you say there are other ways to do it, just a moment ago.
Well, for example, retaliatory, no evictions as retaliation for some kind of valid action and behavior on the part of the landlord. That, I think, is one of the real controversial areas of this measure. It's my own personal opinion that there should not be eviction as retaliation. And I think that could be handled in a two-sentence statute. Accounting for deposits. We don't need a great big long bill to get at the real problem areas, which have been testified to be low-cost housing and low-income families. That can be handled in some other area, because as these witnesses who will follow me will testify, the results are going to be rather dramatic, and they're not going to be for the best interest of the people of our state.
One other question, Mr. Chairman. How do you feel about bringing the FED, forcible entry and detainer law, into the cleaning that up a little bit? The thing I have particularly in mind is, I'm sure you're aware that one statute requires 10-day notice.
Yeah, I know.
We passed last session, yet FED is 3 days. We have direct conflict in law.
Yeah.
Kind of an interesting question for landlords, I suspect.
Yes, it is.
And there are areas that we ought to be cleaning up, should we not?
Well, yeah. Maybe FED should be cleaned up. At least it ought to be made consistent with the stuff on the books. And there are areas where I think that my client would support it. But this is a great big treatment of a very vital subject, and we think that the solution is not good.
Thank you. George, you mentioned that there's a better way of handling, you said there was a lobby place for security deposits. You thought that could be handled at a simple.
Well, I felt that security deposits could be treated by a piece of legislation that need not be larded in to a comprehensive proposal emanating from somewhere else and brought into Oregon as an attempt to solve an Oregon problem.
Well,
How about having a public escrow officer so that all security deposits, last month's rent, everything goes into that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm really not prepared to say what's good about these. We do realize that there are problems and recognize them. I'm just not enough of an expert on anything to be able to come
for guidance, Mr. Bernie.
But, well, I tell you, I represent a bunch of folks who will be glad to offer certain suggestions, and I'm sure others will too.
Thank you.
If you want to use those, I'm sure that we'll have the expertise and the experience to offer them, together with a lot of data on what's happened to other places.
Sure, thank you, Carson. I would appreciate it. Following up the point you're talking about, if you do have suggestions on how to correct that we've had substantial testimony on some very sensitive areas of security deposit repairs and so on, and I very much appreciate your thoughts or your association thoughts on how to correct them.
Yes, I'll find those and I'll discuss them with you. All right, now I've touched on this question. Nobody's asked me any question, really, on this subject, which I thought would bring the greatest interest, and that is the invitation to litigation. And, Mr. Chairman, if we haven't adopted any underlying policy and connected with legislative solutions to factions in our state, I think in each instance we've attempted, for most instances, we have attempted to have these matters resolved by some action other than the courts. It's just too easy under this proposal to get into the courts. And it's too easy to get these matters resolved through litigation, which really is should be the final choice for a solution. There should be many more, maybe arbitration, and maybe the facilities of the association of my client that will provide it, act as a forum for exchange of information. For example, we're confident that many tenants do not realize where their rent buck goes.
How would you? Bernie, that's one reason I asked you about this escrow agent, because I was thinking, in fact, I got some amendments here that that were if all deposits, which are not the landlord's money, until they're due, last month's rent and so forth, we put them in a public escrow agent. I suspect we talked about a couple of $1 million, so that was put out of interest. Seems like we could finance a whole system of referees to arbitrate landlord-tenant disputes and make them binding. They go in there and then we leave the courts out of all together. That would solve this problem you're talking about with all this litigation, which I think you're right. We should set up systems like this to keep them out of court.
What do you think? I'm right. I didn't say that.
Oh, I see.
And I'm not so sure that you're right, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meeker, I suppose this is a comment more than a question, but you've confirmed my suspicions about this bill. The testimony that we've had so far has been presented mostly by lawyers, law schools, and students of law schools. And it appears to me that an accurate listing of you has provided a number of ways we can get into court with this bill. It would be a great assistance to me. I would like to have that right.
I'll give it to you. Well, let's see. Where am I?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm interested in, as a legislator, that's spending an awful lot of time listening to an awful lot of testimony, and perhaps not as much time as some others who were more off with saying, is a section-by-section analysis of the legislation that's before the committee, so that I can hear the countervailing views and make up a judgment. Now, will we reach the point in the discussion of this bill where the opponents of the bill will go over it section by section with us and favor us with their specific views on those sections?
Well, Senator Burns, I don't think we can make them do it if they don't want to do it. This is their time to testify, and I look at the list here, they're going to get another opportunity to testify. The proponents had two sessions. Mr. Clark went over the bill with us.
you'll recall. And two ways of working out a bill, at least two ways, Mr. Burney pointed out, impose it or you go over section by section and you make suggestions for improvement. And I'm under the impression that Mr. Burney has feels his role to go over this bill and point out the things that are particularly bad about it and try to work it out. Now, there's some other legislation around. We've got one bill here, 24, which is over in the House. I understand another one coming in, so I assume that the proponents or opponents of this bill are probably proponents of at least one of those bills, and that's where they plan on putting their energy. But I think it's helpful to listen to their criticism of this bill, and those who on this committee feel it's desirable legislation, I think can find some weaknesses in it, some inequities in it that we may want to correct. I don't know of any other way to proceed.
Accepting what, Mr. Chairman, accepting this one way. If Senator Burns and this committee wants to hear a section by section analysis of the bill, I'd be glad to do it. I'd like to have a little more preparation than I have now because I'm just discussing the bill in a general way and showing why the thrust is in the wrong direction. But it, I can treat it on a section by section basis. It was a little preparation another time.
Senator Carter.
Mr. Chairman, I think in answer to Senator John Burns' comments was that several other areas, we might ask Dean to compare the several bills.
And Dean done that.
For the simple reason, I think Mr. Burns pointed out that if you don't buy most of this bill, it would be idle time to spend trying to rewrite this and conform to what the opponents want to do.
And there will be a comparison of bills in the process being done now. We didn't get 2424 until yesterday. No, I don't mean we got it. It wasn't even printed for yet. Mr. Burns, you know where you are in your testimony. We've interrupted you so many times.
Yeah. Well, I would say that I'm pretty close to the end, Mr. Chairman. After all, mine is supposed to be introductory remarks.
Several days.
Well, I just have one more thing to say, really. And that is on this question of uniformity. I don't think I have all my material with me on this issue. I guess I left something behind. But nevertheless, this is a so-called uniform bill. And our statute touching on uniform state laws and authorizing the commission for which we appropriate money every session to pay for our Oregon commissioners to write these type of laws calls for the type of law for which there is a need of uniformity among the states. Now I submit that although there are numerous areas where this commission on uniform state laws has done noble service in coming forward with uniform laws which each state could apply and adopt and apply and have a benefit because of the interrelation of the peoples of the various states, the landlord-tenant relationship is not one of those. The landlord-tenant relationship is not something for which there is a need for uniformity. This is a wholly local matter. Unlike the Uniform Commercial Code, where people deal between here and Washington, every state in the union on commercial matters, and it's important that they all work under the same law. Not so for landlord and tenant. We're going to have a uniform law come in very shortly. I think it's in now on the uniform no-fault insurance. That has a little more legitimacy on the basis of interstate application, but not landlord-tenant. So if we were going to breathe another criticism, whisper another criticism concerning this bill, it would be that it's offered to us on the basis that the commission has adopted it and that we should adopt it because the commission has urged it, even though, as I maintain and my client maintains, this is a purely local concern. We feel that many of the criticisms and wrongs that this bill attempts to solve are those which originate in the large eastern cities like New York and Detroit and Cleveland and Chicago and a host of others where the problems are multitudinous, and that this perhaps is the type of solution. But we maintain, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that this is not needed in Oregon. There are other ways to handle it. Thank you very much, and I assume you've asked all your questions.
Are there any other questions, Mr. Burney? Senator Speaker.
Final question. It was brought up in discussion of the bill that it does not apply to dormitories.
Yes.
Owned by a school. Would you comment on that particular business environment or to an action in this nature?
Well, I'm sorry I can't. I'm just trying to think back to my dormitory days as a student, and the only gripe I had was about the food. The living quarters were modest, and we had no, and the rent. I'm unable to comment, Senator.
The only gripe I had, we couldn't bring beer to the campus.
Thank you, George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
James Lackey.
Senator Burns, Senators,
I'm the current president of the Oregon Apartment House Association, who represents owners throughout the state, Portland, Klamath Falls, Vail, so on. Also, I'm an owner of an apartment house with rents ranging from $89.50 to $125, top rent for a one-bedroom view apartment located close in southwest Portland. In addition, I've specialized
in... Mr. Lasky, let me interrupt you a second. We don't have a PA system in here. I know some of the people back there would like to hear you too, if you could speak up a little bit.
Thank you. In addition, I've specialized for over 20 years in selling investment real estate with a heavy emphasis on apartments. Coming back to my experience as an apartment owner, I run around a 5% vacancy, which is usually exceeded by people to be a healthy vacancy rate. In other words, I have to be good to tenants, tenants have to be fair in return. As far as security deposits, I don't take any. We take a non-refundable $28 cleaning fee. This is understood at the beginning, and we have no difficulty with that. Now, $28 for a bachelor apartment and $30 for a one-bedroom. We consider this reasonable, and we have no difficulty with that. We feel that the intent of the bill sponsors is good and of the highest purpose and well-motivated. But we feel that the problems that exist in New York City, Chicago, and other cities like that, fortunately, don't exist here. We have problems, but certainly not in the new housing. In new housing throughout the state, you can get almost anything but dancing girls. When we go to low-cost housing, a severe problem exists. We simply don't have enough of it. And as James Clark pointed out, this bill will not solve the low-cost housing problem. What I would like to point out is I'm afraid it's going to make it much worse, to increase the cost of operation and discouragement of new development. The housing building situation is very volatile. As we know, interest rates go up some, no building, and then they're down some, going, and away we go. Our organization and property owners in general, I feel, have been quite remiss in public relations in pointing out and showing where the rental dollar goes. In other words, how much are property owners making on their investment? Now, if a person owns a property free and clear, the average apartment will net between 6% and 8%. Now, out of that 6% to 8%, you have to have a reserve for replacement of such things like appliances, roof, gutters, painting. In addition to that, you have a building that's getting older, and some reserve, or at least recognition of the fact, should be kept in mind. The thing that keeps apartments in the investment ballpark at all is the fact that if you're lucky enough to be able to hold on to it, inflation will make it worth more, and there are tax benefits due to being able to subtract a portion of the value of the building is worth each year. The relationship between landlord and tenant has been referred to as feudalistic, and this seems somewhat inappropriate in a nation that does rank number one in housing in the world. But this isn't to deny the fact that we do have severe problems in low-cost housing. But we claim that this is going to require a cooperation between the public and the private sector, and not trying to solve the problem with current underpopulated number of housing units. In general, I reiterate and say that I think that an omnibus bill such as this is going to discourage ownership and development, and especially the low-income renter. And they're the ones that are in problem of what to do for them. I don't have the answer. There are 8,000 people waiting in Portland for low-cost housing now. A strict enforcement of housing codes excluding safety, with which no one could argue, would probably add another 10 or 20,000 immediately. So this is severe and a heart-rending situation. From the number of complaints that have been reported, considering the fact that there are, say, a couple hundred thousand rental units, several hundred complaints or even 1,000 complaints would, to me, just seem to be a rather free flow type of interchange as far as tenant complaints go. We maintain that it's a small percentage of landlords that are causing the trouble. In the same respect, a very small percentage of tenants are the ones that cause the trouble. But this, call it 2 or 3% arbitrarily, are the ones that I would estimate cause 90% of the difficulty. And most of the trouble I see with this omnibus bill is it is an open invitation for this, unfortunately, sometimes talented 3% aggressive to just have continuous litigation. Again, our good housing depends quite a bit on free competition. In citing the case of New York, we have cases where people actually donate apartment houses to simply get a tax write-off. They abandon approximately 40,000 units a year. And much of this is due to oppressive and heavy-handed legislation. And fortunately, I'm glad I don't even have to discuss problems in New York City. I think it's that bad. I'd like to comment just on a few of the sections. On Section 31, which allows a counterclaim in lieu of rent and court payment during this time. There is no provision where the court is instructed to do such things as make payments on mortgages. Very few property owners are in a fortunate situation enough to own them free and clear. And it doesn't take much litigation to tie a property up 2 or 3 months, but that's enough to really raise havoc with the status of your mortgage. Many mortgages state that it automatically goes from, say, 8 to 10% penalties, and they have all sorts of other recourse. And I'm sure it's possible that it wouldn't be unusual for it to stretch into many months, in which case it'd be a pure disaster for everyone concerned. In addition, much of the health of available building depends upon availability of mortgage money. And mortgage companies simply viewing this threat as it is now, I'm sure would consider apartments that much less investment. New York City, my understanding is that there simply is no mortgage money, unless it be for the $500 a month and up tenant. In Section 29, which allows the tenant to make repairs up to $100 or one half of the month's rental, whichever is greater, to me, invites truly a horrendous state of chaos. Most landlords can state almost traumatic experiences simply by a tenant painting a property. And it's very difficult to get workmen that do, that is, the run-of-the-mill qualified workmen is tough enough nowadays to get him, period, and to get it with a workmanlike manner. Things that need to be done, I feel, is already covered by existing laws, and that a strict enforcement of existing building codes will take care of them. That we don't need new laws for that. We need enforcement of existing laws and a statewide code. This will cover so many things that, that this omnibus bill brings up, that, that to enforce what we already have.
Let me interrupt, Mr. Chairman. I think that's a, an extremely legitimate, valid point. We have people trying to pass laws, not only here, but at the city level, in the city I represent, to cure a situation which, to some extent, could be cured if they would enforce the current existing codes through their own departments. So I don't want what you said to be overlooked, because that is a very legitimate point. And that's, I've got a long history of arguing, as I said at the last meeting, with welfare and the Board of Health and other agencies that close their eyes to violations of existing codes. So.
Yes, the Apartment House Association under no circumstances wants to condone slum landlords. Or slumlords of any sort.
You want to speak up a little bit louder?
Yes, thank you. Under section 43, which has to do with retaliatory eviction, there again, 97% of the tenants don't concern me at all, but of the 3% of the troublemakers, it's so easy, I don't think there's one out of buildings that wouldn't have something wrong at one time. Last week somebody stole a fire extinguisher, and for 24 hours I was in technical violation until we discovered it and bought a new one. But technically someone could be in the property, a troublemaker could be in the property for a year, and the problems that a talented troublemaker can do for the building and other tenants are truly staggering. This one factor alone would, to many property owners, just reduce the value of it tremendously, because normal operation has enough problems without something like that. In section 12, it has the word at section 12, we have unconscionability. Well, this sounds bad, and I'm sure it is bad, but as an apartment house operator, I would have to live in constant dread that at any hour of the day I might be committing, because it isn't specific. And something that vague, I think, again, is another invitation for litigation to increase costs both for tenants and landlords. Under section 21, it mentions complying with city codes, laws, health, and so on, which is fine. But it goes on to, again, fit and habitable. And fit and habitable, to me, as an apartment house broker, seems in the eyes of the beholder, because I will look at a $1,000 a month suite and a $75 a month rental, and this can really be a matter of interpretation. I think of a specific case of a girl who was making $500 a month, renting a one-bedroom apartment for $75, basement apartment. She is very happy with it, but she truly concedes that aesthetically it's very poor, needs paint and new linoleum, needs new sink, and so on. But she lives in constant dread that the landlord will upgrade it, which means her rent will go up to $100 a month. Now, she's paying a student loan, she has a Volkswagen that needs rather constant repair, and $25 to her can represent a financial crisis. This type of thing, considering that many people are trying to get by on Social Security and have much less income, and that creates a problem again. So again, I come back to the point of existing codes, safety, and that is, we're certainly for. But where it comes into a matter of vague interpretation and possibly just aesthetics, I think it should be spelled out and left on the free marketplace line. Because many tenants would prefer to have a minimum maintenance building, especially the ones on Social Security and low income, rather than to have somebody really make it fancy and then the rents go right beyond their means. And then thereby making the existing problems of low cost housing that much worse. Section 38 abolishes the landlord's lien. We prefer to have that because it is, in many cases, the only protection against a small minority of tenants who skip out. Section 37 is a waiver of landlord's right to terminate. And I interpret this section as meaning the tenant, for example, if a tenant isn't paying his rent, then he has a legitimate excuse and it's temporary. In most cases, you'd accept part rent and say you'll make up the rest in a month or a week, whenever he can. But under this section, I interpret it that if you ameliorate the situation or bargain in any way whatsoever, you've rescinded all your rights whatsoever. Again, here's another case to where you have to come on belligerent and without any human aspect whatsoever. On section 34, which requires written notice when a tenant is delinquent for rent and then 14 days for him to make it up, changes the present law where 10 days. Now, rent is a recurring thing, and really, I think almost all tenants know that every month it is due. In my apartment and in many property owners, rents that are due the first are paid anywhere up to the 15th, and sometimes with old-time tenants, they pay any time during the month, and you're not going to raise heck about it. But with this adds another 14 days, it adds all sorts of paperwork. It would almost necessitate giving a letter about the second of the month to everybody, which again would raise all sorts of antagonism and insult a great many great tenants. And so again, we foster ill will and litigation. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Are there questions to Mr. Lasky?
I have Mr. Lasky agree as a landlord that it might be in the public interest to have some kind of a statute of limitations shorter than what we presently have, covering both landlord and tenant's rights. What I'm concerned about is a situation where a person has, say, a month-to-month rental agreement. They move out and say 18 months or 2 years later, the landlord would say, or I suppose it could conversely say the tenant, I'm thinking of the landlord instituting a suit against the tenant for damages to the leasehold.
Senator Burns, not speaking for myself and not the association on this particular case, in the apartment house I have of 48 units, in the last 5 years we have the customary number of people, perhaps more because in the location we are, we have a more transient type of tenant. On King Avenue, just south of Burnside, southwest, Marshall Arms Apartments. Concrete brick building. Now, I don't, in the last 5 years, I haven't gone after one, because an attorney's time is worth money, and the amount of rent and so on simply isn't there. Now, this wouldn't, some people would, but to me, the time involved and attorney's costs and so on, it isn't a problem.
I'm familiar with one case where somebody has gone after somebody, and two years after the fact, what transpired 2 years ago is largely forgotten, wasn't memorialized in writing, and there will be litigation, and court isn't particularly helped in that instance, and I'm wondering if it really wouldn't be in the public interest to say that you should be limited with respect to time in pursuing your remedy. That is, if there was an injustice done, one way or the other, at the time the leasehold was vacated, isn't in the public interest to speed up the process so that it can be resolved perhaps more quickly than the present law provides?
To me personally, that seems very reasonable.
If you require the first and last month's rent in advance, then that take care of the situation?
The only thing in advance that I require in my apartment is the $28 and $30 cleaning fee.
When you're talking about people leaving up paying rent and so forth, if you have the last month's rent there, and if they don't pay, you've got 30 days to pay for the rent, and you can get them out of that length of time.
Yep, Senator Burns, most of the people who can afford to pay the first and last month plus the deposit are not in the group that caused the difficulty. Because on the average tenant, that's a pretty tough thing to do.
Well,
and especially in lower cost housing, where most of the problems are.
But aren't you just really buying from, it's kind of like the guy that wants to sell a house so bad that he sells a $20,000 house and gets a $500 down payment. You know, it's just buying trouble. And if that's the way the housing market's got to be to have the last month's rent, that's the way it's got to be to resolve this problem.
Well, possibly my answer to that would be that let me ponder this.
What would you do in your case? I think I've noticed ads here in Salem where they'll give the first month rent free just to get you in there.
Right.
Well, I know that. But,
now this is where the problem will arise. From some of the tenancies. Now, my policy and the advice is to try to screen tenants, because when you rent an apartment, you are in effect lending money to the person. You're entrusting them with an asset worth several thousand dollars up. And so if possible, you try to screen them somewhat to see that they are employed or with chances of employment or with a proper form or some viable form of paying rent.
Another question, Mr. Lasky. Do you have a business card, Mr. Lasky?
Yeah.
Can you get the card? Thank you. Mrs. Faw?
My interest in low-cost housing goes back a good many years.
We want to have your name on the...
my complete name.
And your address.
Maureen Faw, Portland, Oregon.
Do you have an address where we can reach you?
Yes, 01944 Southwest Palatine Hill Road in Portland. I'm the owner of rental property at present time, and my interest in low-cost housing has gone back a great many years, to the 30s, in fact, when I was a teacher around Bakersfield, California, and a good many of my students were from Hoover Village, described so ably by Steinbeck. At that time, we were required to visit the home of each child. And as you visited these homes of the children who lived in packing boxes, dwellings made of pieces of tarp and this sort of thing, you saw something that you'd never forget. After that, we spent a good many years in Chicago, where we ourselves lived in low-cost housing, the typical Chicago share the bath, cockroach-ridden window boxes instead of ice boxes or refrigerators. And so I know a little of what low-cost housing is from living in it. Then more recently, as we have been in Portland for about the last 20 years, we have owned some low-cost housing. And so, as I think of this bill, I think in terms of what it will do to the tenant who is paying a low amount of rent. As I look at the bill, I think of what it'll do to the people on Social Security, the college students who are working their way through, and a number of these people that we have who live from week to week and aren't employed all the time. And the only thing I can figure out, speaking from my own experience, is that he will have to pay more because of the bill. The tenants will all have to pay more because of the bill, but the person in low-cost housing will have to pay more because he's spending much more of his dollar for housing. Some people are spending only 20% of their dollar for housing, but the person who has only a couple hundred dollars a month is spending pretty close to half of his income for housing. So costs are much more for him than for the person with money. Now, there are several parts of this bill that, according to my experience, will especially raise costs for the type of tenant that we have. There are a couple of sections that I think are an invitation to the opportunist to take advantage of these situations and use up extra days of free rent. And these extra days of free rent are really terribly important to the person who is operating close to the margin. I'm thinking particularly of Section 44-2A that gives the tenant 14 days after written notice. Now the tenant has 10 days if he's in arrears in rent. Now, if you have to give this written notice, even if you're right on the ball and looking for this, it's going to take you at least 5 or 6 days to get this written notice into the hands of the tenant, and then 14 days gives him 4 more days than the 10 that he already allows. Now, I'm thinking that will run up 9 or 10 days more of free time for this opportunist to get. Well, this is real important when you're running close to the margin, because even at $3 a day for your rental unit, this would run you up to $30, this extra 10 days. And for $30, I could get a studio apartment decorated for that tenant that really needs it. It would make it a lot more habitable for him. Or another thing, you're always having trouble in low-cost housing with cockroaches. You can make a good down payment on exterminating them for that $30. And so this means that your tenants aren't going to get this because the money isn't there. And then under Section 43, under retaliatory conduct, this is another one that I feel is going to cost the low-paying tenant a great deal because of the high percentage of his dollar that goes for rent. Now, under this, as I read it, if a tenant causes a lot of trouble, may bother the other tenants a great deal, you still can't get him out of the apartment without it being interpreted as retaliatory action unless you go to court over this. And again, when you're operating on a low margin, this is a real threat, litigation. And then I can see where this would be a real imposition on the low-cost tenant. Now, in higher-priced housing, if there's somebody who's making a lot of noise, the people he bothers can move. You can do these things if you have money, but if you don't have money, you can't move, no matter how much someone bothers you or how noisy they are. So I can see where this could really make it unpleasant for the person in a low-income group. And that the cost would really weigh heavily on the low-cost rental occupancy. Another thing that bothers me because of the cost is Section 49. And I'm thinking maybe in terms of almost pennies, and I'm thinking in terms of $30 and $40, but that when you are doing some of this and doing it in a low-cost way, these relatively small amounts can be awfully important. Authorizing self-help for defects. Now, this can cause a lot of extra trouble and expense. In the over 20 years that we have been in this, we have really found that very few people, well-meaning people, are competent of doing workmanlike work themselves or able to get it done. This is a difficult thing. I can think of a tenant actually who was a very good, conscientious, a fine person, and most of these people really want to be helpful. And he wanted to have something done. He said, "Now, just leave this to me because I have this friend who is a licensed electrician and he will do it right. I wouldn't think, of course, of charging you for it because I want it." And so we paid no more attention there, and we were just horrified when these people moved out because of the hazard this supposedly licensed electrician had caused during a brief period of time. And so it's really very hazardous and also expensive if work isn't well done, particularly if people do something that involves the walls, the ceiling of the building. And as you have to pay more on this, of course, this is going on. And as you get into your poorer people, it's a much heavier burden. I think in housing, the poor person has already, well, as I say, way back in the 30s, this began, been saddled with far more than his share to put up with. And I just can't see him saddled with any more on this. Now, you may think that the owner can absorb more of this, but as has been pointed out, you can just absorb a certain amount of it. And particularly on low-cost rentals, all rentals, I'm sure, all rental property, but particularly in low cost, the owners and the tenants have been hit with inflation and higher taxes. It costs so much more to have these maintenance acts performed, and taxes have gone up so very fast on low-income property. And, well, for instance, another thing that has raised the cost for the poor tenant is sewer costs. Of course, everybody pays that $3 a month for the sewer, but again, $3 is so much more for the poor person than it is for the person with five times as much money as he has. And so as I look at this bill and think of it penalizing all renters, I see it penalizing the poor person much more than I see it penalizing anyone else. And in addition to penalizing the poor person, I think that it will probably dry up a certain amount of the pretty fair rental housing that he may have available to him. I doubt if very much the low-cost housing is really good, what all of us would like to live in, but I think I may be right, I don't have figures on this, that the owners of much low-cost housing, the ownership consists of the little people. I have attended various meetings of the association. Now, I remember sitting at the table with one man who had several rather low-cost units. He had a service station, and he told me how he took these little houses, and he would go around and mow the lawns and paint, and that he rather enjoyed doing this because it's a creative thing. And I have an idea that he probably was doing a pretty fair job of it. And I remember sitting with another woman who had 14 units somewhere, I think, and she seemed to be much interested in it, and she had had some carpeting which she'd had for only 3 years, and it had given out, and she was very much interested in finding something durable and inexpensive to put in this. Well, if you're worrying about carpeting after 3 years, I think it indicates some sort of concern. And I just wonder how much legal threat comparatively small people can actually work under. You're working on such a close margin as it is that I have a feeling that this may influence low-cost housing adversely. And this is my main fear.
Okay, thanks very much, Mrs. Bach. I appreciate it. Were you finished?
Yes. This is my last statement.
Thank you. Now, is it Mr. Daigle? Just how long is your report going to take?
10 minutes, 15.
Okay, let me just find out. Mr. Keating, you're from Eugene. You've indicated it's going to take 10 minutes when you put this down. Have there been some things that have already been said that you're not going to have to say again, and therefore it'll be less than 10 minutes?
I'd like to, if I may, relinquish my position on the schedule there to Mr. Bill Lamb.
Is he from Eugene?
He is from Portland. He's from the National Association of Home Builders and will not be available for a subsequent hearing. For this reason, I would like to relinquish the time allotted to me to be in.
Where are you from, Mr. Daigle?
Portland. Can you hear both of them?
Well, we got a few other people here, like about 20. What I'm trying to do here, we had a lot of testimony from tenants in Eugene. In fact, a great deal of our testimony was, I'd like to have somebody representing landlords interest from Eugene to testify today, and I'll think we can still do that and still take Mr. Lamb and Mr. Dyke. How long is your testimony going to take?
3 months.
Just the one I'm looking for.
I'll even read it so that I don't get all those andas and ifs and real
forth. Please tell us your name and address.
My name is Marion Hessel, and my husband and I have owned rental property in Eugene since 1966. Most of our tenants are university students, and with few exceptions, I think we would be considered reasonable landlords. Our students may have a different idea. I think it's too bad that time does not permit the hearing to be set up so that tenants and landlords could testify on the same day. Or maybe the committee, in their infinite wisdom, did not wish to set it up this way because they didn't want to act as referees. But it would be good for us to listen to each other. I'm appalled at the stories that our tenants tell me about landlords and their unfair and even illegal treatment, and I feel that the stories they tell me are perfectly justified. But I'm equally appalled about what happens to our property. And if you'll just permit me three brief examples, and I won't say refrigerators, pets, I will say a pet, okay. A pet kept in the apartment for 6 months, never taken out, no cleanup committee. This despite our rule against pets. A refrigerator that was so heavy with frost in the freezing compartment that the door had a chair against it in order to keep the door shut. A tenant who painted a room despite an agreement in our rental that no painting was permitted without permission. Ceilings, walls, and floors navy blue. And I could go on for at least, if we've owned this property for a long time, I could go on for an hour. But it's not, I don't feel the intent of the hearing to cite personal grievances. But if the committee members are interested, I would be glad to supply them with actual figures of operating costs, plumbing maintenance, and so forth. I have them over that period of time. Much of it a result of misuse by tenants, so that they may realize the problems of the landlord. We get no return on our investment. We only hope that our subsidy of the property will permit us to hold on to our investment until the mortgage is paid off and we can realize a little retirement income from it. I feel there are many, I would venture to say the majority of the landlords who are in this same position. It is also not my intent to cite specific points of criticism of this bill, but permit me one example. Under Section 21, subsection F, supply running water and reasonable amounts of hot water at all times. I have tenants who can run through a tank of water with a shower. And this particularly delights me. Reasonable heat between October 1st and May 1st. Now, May is a pretty cold month in Oregon, but according to this bill, I can turn off the heat the 1st of May, and I may just do that. In conclusion, I would like to say that I don't like the adversary procedure. Isn't that what the lawyers call it, where you're kind of fighting back and forth? Where there are reasonable tenants and reasonable landlords, I think the present law should be sufficient. Where there are unreasonable landlords and reasonable tenants, perhaps this bill will help. And when there are unreasonable tenants and reasonable landlords, heaven help the landlord if this bill passes. Thank you.
Mr. Temple, thank you very much. And those figures you're talking about would be of interest to me, and I think the rest of the members of the committee
would
be glad to supply those.
Yes, indeed. We'll do that.
Mr. Geiger, you said your testimony is going to take how long?
10 minutes.
Well, we got our choice of having Mr. Lamb or having you. Mr. Lamb says he can't come back.
3 minutes.
3 minutes?
3 minutes.
We'll take you both.
My name is Bill Lamb, and I'm here representing the National Association of Home Builders, also representing the Multifamily Council of Portland, also representing myself as a low and moderate income builder and manager of rental units in the city of Portland, city of the Dalles. The National Association of Home Builders has taken this bill under advisement less than 2 months ago. As you know, it's a uniform act passed by mostly professors and mostly lawyers, and not too many landlords and not too many tenants were considered. It was intended to be a study bill. I was surprised that it was introduced into this legislature without more impact from other sources. I have a copy of their line-by-line analyst of the bill. I must tell you that they are in favor of a uniform type of law because they feel that most states are representing or acting on laws that are pretty medieval. And I will be glad to give you one of these impact studies. I'm here today opposing the bill because it needs more study. It needs more consideration. As the bill is written at the present time, if passed, it would only hurt those low and moderate income people. As a builder of low and moderate income properties, and I was going to make a kind of a career of this, but suddenly in the last few years, certain laws have been changed, certain landlord rights have been abused, and therefore I decided that it was too tough to compete in this field and have now raised my type of building to other rental units. I want you to understand that 50% of all the building throughout the nation today is rental. That's why the National Association of Home Builders is well concerned with this type of legislation. Since this bill has been brought out of study, I have a list of a lot of changes that the national tenant organizations have asked that be made already. There is a Senate bill or a House bill here in your legislature that has a lot of amendments that the landlords would like to see. What I'm saying, gentlemen, is that the present law, while it's slanted towards the tenant, is better than a new revolutionary law that might cause a lot of chaos and cause a lot of undue hardship on the low-income people. I think this law, and I think the national support says in stating that there needs a lot of study, needs a lot of impact. This law, as analyzed by the National, has been sent out to all its members throughout the whole United States and asking for impact studies to become fed back in. When that impact is back in, I think we'll come up with a good law. I think that this is what it needs here, more study. As I say, the present law are workable. They're doing a fairly good job. And with that, gentlemen, I'll conclude. Is there any questions?
Have this.
Yes, I'll give you a copy. And remind, I want to put it in the record that this is for study only. While it leans towards favoritism of the law, it was intended for study. It has lots of the opposition, in other words, landlords and the tenants still should have rights to make an impact into this study.
Any questions, Mr. Lamb? Thank you very much, Mr. Lamb. Mr. Daigle? While Mr. Daigle is coming up here, our next meeting is going to be on Tuesday. It's going to be on landlord-tenant again inviting opponents to come and testify. The committee will convene at 8:30, and we're going to hear some testimony on SB 359, which is a bill introduced by Senator Meeker. That's going to take us 15 minutes, and then we're going to start back on this subject again. And I think that's probably going to bring to an end our hearings on this bill. Then we're going to go into work session, unless there's specific witnesses that the committee feels can give us answers to specific questions we have.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Paul Daigle.
Do you have a business card?
Yes, sir, I do.
We'll get it.
vice president of a property management and real estate development company in Portland, and I was 1972 president of the Oregon Apartment Association. The Oregon Apartment Association opposes this legislation for two basic reasons. The first is that this legislation, by changing the rules, gives tenants some arbitrary powers and rights which will be subject to abuse to the detriment of the good tenants. The majority of the good tenants will suffer from the expense, from the difficulty, from the trouble that will be caused by a few. We feel that to prohibit the free termination of rental contracts by either party will make the property owner an unwilling supplier of housing to an unhappy, a disgruntled buyer, which is an extremely unpleasant situation that can last a year. The main basic reason that we oppose this is that by hurting the private housing industry, in the long run, it's going to decrease the supply of housing, it's going to hurt the people that it's intended to help. This effect has occurred where this legislation has been put into effect. The Oregon Apartment Association believes in a constructive approach to the specific problem, which is enforce, require, procure repairs in the low-cost sector. No question about it. In the low-cost sector, people are abused by what we feel is a minority of landlords, and we do not defend this type of landlord. The Oregon Apartment Association stands and has stood for professional, efficient operation with a fair shake for our customers, the renters. We believe that tenants should collect damages, and they are entitled to at the present. It is possible now for tenants to sue for damages. We believe that unsafe, unsanitary housing should be brought up to standard by strict enforcement of strict housing codes. We feel that rental contracts freely entered into between both parties creates a healthy climate, which makes the development of new housing feasible and desirable. It will continue. If you give excessive powers, if you give excessive discretion to tenants, it will lead to abuse, it will lead to increased costs, which all tenants will have to cover. The association has long advocated strongly to its members that security deposits should be strictly accounted for. That is one of the least objectionable parts of this bill, which we regard, unfortunately, in its major aspects as undesirable. This industry, you know, it's not like a public utility, it's not like the automobile industry. This industry is made up of thousands upon thousands of small owners. I don't think any single owner in the United States has as much as 1% of the housing units in the United States. It's not like where two utilities control a city or where five automobile companies can control an industry. When President Nixon's office removed price controls, they said they did so because this industry is competitive. It's highly competitive. It's fragmented. It's thousands upon thousands of small owners, and the tenant is not the victim of a few overpowerful landlords. There's a difference, a tremendous difference, between sensible housing codes which concentrate on health and safety and a new provision in this law which will leave it first to the tenant and presumably later to a court to decide whether or not something is fit and habitable. You must remember the majority, the vast bulk of rental housing is not low end. There are probably as many people in extremely expensive rental units as there are in extremely cheap units. The bulk of it is in between. Fit and habitable is undefined. Presumably, a body of law would be created eventually to define it. But how much more sensible it is to simply enforce the housing codes which exist and should be strengthened. As far as being competitive, in the apartments that the company that I'm with manages, we can't get a deposit of the last month's rent. It's too competitive. People will balk at that. We do collect a cleaning fee. We have no deposits. We had, within the last few days, an occupant of a very high-priced apartment. Her baths were wired so that when you turn on the light, the fan went on. And this is a new apartment, and that is required by the building code at this time. She wanted that fan wired independently of the lights, which actually is a pretty good idea, because every time you go in the bathroom, flip it on, the fan goes on. She called in an electrician and had it done. It cost about $50. Now, at this point, there is an honest difference of opinion as to whether or not that was necessary to make that fit and habitable, because in her eyes, that was necessary. She didn't enjoy that bathroom with the air blowing through it. The point is that this question of fit and habitable is different on a low-cost housing place and on something that's expensive. I foresee its abuse, because most people will not know the details of this. All they'll know is that the landlord is required to make any repairs necessary. I think that summarizes my testimony, sir.
Can you make copies of your testimony, of course, or we'll make a copy for you and return it to you?
Well, I've kind of ad-libbed a bit from this. Okay. Whatever you say, of course.
Well, it's up to you if you'd like to have it. Senator Jernstedt.
I have several questions that probably I should have asked before, and they're more or less general. What do you consider to be the low cost for to make it low-cost housing and regular housing? It's dollars per month for an apartment.
Well, I think the break is probably someplace around $125 to $130. Now, below that, and it does go below that, you can find rentals in Portland $40 and $50. $130, frankly, it's pretty hard to find a very sizable, very decent two-bedroom apartment above below $130. That's sort of a break point. In the low-cost end, there is probably less competition than there is in the vast bulk of this thing. But that is a separate problem. This bill cannot create housing. We feel it will do the opposite. Whether it could or not, though, obviously the answer is to create low-cost housing.
How many units does a landlord have to own to be considered for membership in your organization?
Well, actually one, you see.
What?
One.
How many are there in Oregon?
How many
apartments?
Total apartments?
Yeah.
I don't really know. I believe the association does not have good figures on the total number of rental units. For one thing, you see, it changes every day.
Where this relationship would exist.
You ask how many landlords there are in Oregon?
Yeah.
Well, you see, I really don't know. It changes every day.
How many belong to your association?
Oh, something over 1,000. Over the state, we have members on the coast, in the valley, southeast Oregon, northeast Oregon, central Oregon, all over the state.
Mr. Dyer, I think you said where this legislation is in effect now, it's not working?
Yes, sir.
Pardon?
Yes, sir.
In what state are you referring to?
I was thinking especially of New York. New York City, of course, is a subject all to itself. New York City has had a combination of required maintenance plus rent controls. Now, these rent controls have been, again, a separate subject, because rent controls were placed on existing properties. new properties were free of rent controls. But the combination of required maintenance and the laws, incidentally, the regulation in some areas there, New York City, New Jersey, and some other areas, are stiffer by far than this law. They provide, for instance, for a complete abatement of rent during a time an apartment is deemed unfit. Anyway, the simplest thing in the world happens. You can't raise the rent. You're required to maintain it. You haven't got the money to do it. You pour your own money into it about so long, and then you walk away from it. And the first thing you know, you have a vacant, empty building standing there. Now, this is an extreme. I don't say that this would do it in Oregon, but this is a step in that direction. In New York, the last gimmick, next to the last gimmick was the City Council of New York, yielding to tenant pressure, proposed a property tax abatement program, a tax credit program, and they announced it. We're going to solve the housing situation in New York because if anybody will build new apartments, we're going to give them a rent credit for a varying period of years for a certain varying percentage. The large developers in New York, the reaction was mixed. Some of them said, we'll take anything we can get. Most of them said, this is not going to solve the problem. We still will not develop property in New York. The last thing that came up in this New York area, some property owners, supposedly, now I've read this, I don't know that it's a fact, go down and deed their property to some charity. And so the Red Cross or the UGN wakes up and finds they own a building because the property owner is going to divest himself of any liability for it. The building stands there vacant. The utilities are turned off. Somebody breaks a window. They go in and they camp in it. Dreadful situation. Now, admittedly, this is downtown tenement New York. I don't think this type of bill would cure that situation there, and I don't think it would help in Oregon.
Another question, Mr. Dagle. The committee, bear with me. Mr. Cordes has a, I think, want to comment on his statement, but leave it with us. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Why don't we do that, and you will have to come back and forth. And,
thank you.
I want to thank all the witnesses for cooperating so we get as much input here today as we could with the time we had. And any of those who didn't have an opportunity to testify, it's difficult for you to come back. If you want to send something to us in writing, we'll be assured that it will be distributed among all the committee to read. If any of you come from the same area and know each other, you might kind of coordinate your testimony. And so when you come back on Tuesday, you'll give more people an opportunity to testify.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll make this brief. I left a copy of a short prepared statement with the clerk. My name is Wayne Cordes, an attorney in Portland, Oregon, appearing on behalf of the Association of Oregon Executive Directors of Housing Authorities. We are requesting, if action is taken on the bill, that application of the bill be changed by an amendment which we propose to eliminate occupancies under rental agreements with housing authorities. But we have some concerns that have already been expressed, which we won't go into, particularly in connection with litigation, security deposits. I might say there were two representatives or two housing authority directors that have left who might have been able to answer questions I wouldn't. But there is this concern. We are heavily dominated by federal regulations and restrictions. They tell us to a great extent what it has to be included in lease agreements and so forth. I think housing authorities are recognized as unique in Oregon. They're prohibited from making any profit on the on their lease agreements. I didn't hear prior testimony by proponents. I don't know what, if anything, was said about housing authorities. Generally, hopefully, that wasn't unfavorable. but we'll attempt to get more specific information if you desire. But because of our unique situation as a landlord, because of our heavy federal involvement as to lease requirements, lease expenditure,
Wait,
and so forth.
You're talking primarily about where they, the housing authority goes into a 5-year lease and then supplements the rent and so forth. Is this the main area you're talking about?
Yes, yes. Housing authorities provide, under Oregon law, properties for low-income families. And in some instances, housing authorities, for instance, in Portland, own property, which they lease. And in other instances, they lease property from private ownership and then sublease to other persons. And then the difference between the rentals is made up primarily, I understand, by federal funds.
Aren't they up around 1,000 units or something? Because they're not really important.
I think the housing authority actually is involved in about 3,000 units in Portland.
Of leasing?
Yes, sir.
That's the HAP.
Yes.
Chairman, one thing that concerns me about it is my observation that the biggest slumlord in Salem is the Salem Housing Authority. Your proposal to take it out would also affect the Salem Housing Authority. Could you comment on what we're going to do about housing authorities that are running some of the crummiest homes in Salem? How do we get at them? That was one of the good parts of this bill, I thought.
Well, Senator, I'm not aware of that particular situation. A representative of the Marion County Housing Authority was here, which I understand is different than the City of Salem. And our proposal would be to only take out those formed under the actual housing authority statutes.
Ah, okay. That might be
I think the Salem has its own housing under some different law.
Okay.
Senator Burns?
Wayne, Clackamas County Housing Authority is formed under the housing authority statutes, right?
That's my understanding, yes, Senator.
I had some complaints of a rather serious nature from him arising out of situations there. And I just, I don't know. Maybe we can visit about it, but I didn't handle it as a lawyer because it involved an agency, but it was some difficult. I don't think we have a problem with the Portland Housing Authority, in my judgment, but I think there's a problem out there.
That could well be. I might say Mr. Telford from Clackamas County was here and then he left. But I'll certainly try to get more information concerning that.
Are there other questions, Ms. Curtis? Thank you, Wayne. We got your statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Meeting is adjourned.